All right. Let's go ahead and open a word of prayer. We just thank you, Father. We thank you for this time. Thank you for your word. And just pray that you would help me as I go through this passage tonight. And may it be clear. And just think of all the ministries that are taking place tonight, Lord, that you would be glorified in each one, that the word would take root in lives, and we would grow in your grace. In Christ's name we pray, amen. Okay, well, we're going to cover 8 verses. I think it is possible. I think we will accomplish this. This is the Jew part 3, but in many ways, this is a digression. I'll talk about that in a moment. But, you know, Paul, he's been confronting the moralist, okay? He's been confronting the moralist, pagan. He's been confronting the Jew, who is like the arch-moralist, okay? He's the arch-moralist. And he's been facing them with the reality of the day of the Lord. The day of judgment. Let's just call it that. We'll call it the day of judgment. And the moralist pagan falls short because of his what? What's he going to be judged by? Yeah, he's falling short because he's not obeying the light that God's given to him in his conscience. The Jew, on the other hand, falls short of what? Yeah, keeping the law. Okay, so different standards are applied to them, but God is still impartially judging them both according to their deeds. All right, both will be judged according to their deeds. Now, in this context, Paul tells them of a particular uncircumcised man who we identified as a Gentile. He keeps the requirements of the law. He is a Jew inwardly. He is circumcised of heart. His designation of Jew, okay, comes from God, not from man. And most shockingly, and this is what leads into our passage today, most shockingly, at least to Jewish ears, is this idea that this uncircumcised man will end up judging the Jew, okay? He's going to end up judging the Jew. And this is just an astounding reality. And this, what we see now in verses 1 through 8 of chapter 3, is most likely an immediate just kind of response that Paul, automatic response that Paul has. Because whenever he shared this truth, the Jews immediately launch into criticisms of what he has just shared with them. And so this is an astounding reality that God will treat a Gentile like a Jew, okay, while the Jew will be treated the way they thought the Gentiles were going to be treated, right? They were going to be led away. They were going to be judged, and the Jews were going to be the prominent ones on Judgment Day. Paul says, no, actually, there'll be Gentiles that will judge you. This is nothing more than what Jesus said. I didn't really have time to share these last week, but let's take a moment this week. In Matthew chapter 12, he speaks of Gentiles who will judge the Jew. The men of Nineveh will stand up with this generation at the judgment and will condemn it because they repented at the preaching of Jonah. And behold, something greater than Jonah is here. The queen of the south will rise up with this generation at the judgment and will condemn it because she came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon. And behold, something greater than Solomon is here. This is essentially what Paul has been sharing. And so you could see where the Jews didn't receive Jesus very well, and they're not going to receive Paul very well when he shares the same reality. As far as this idea of God treating Gentiles like he intended to treat the Jews, is here in Matthew chapter 8. He marveled and said to those who are following, this is when he's responding to the centurion. The centurion has such great faith, he thinks Jesus can heal with a word, okay, without actually showing up at his house. Healing his, I think it's his son. It's either a son or a servant. Truly, I say to you, I have not found such great faith with anyone in Israel. I say to you that many will come from east and west and recline at the table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. But the sons of the kingdom will be cast out into the outer darkness. In that place, there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. So again, Jesus referred to this reversal that Paul has been outlining for us, that there would be these Gentiles who, be, you know, because of their faith, okay, will have brought forth the works of the law. They will stand in judgment of the Jews. They will go into the kingdom. They will participate in the promises given to Abraham, but the Jews, the sons of the kingdom, as he calls them here, the ones to whom it belonged, okay, that it was intended for, they will not experience it. They will be in the place of weeping and gnashing of teeth. So just to show you there that again, the correlation between Jesus and Paul in this matter. So in the mention of the circumcision of the heart by Paul, performed by the Spirit, Paul begins to give the solution for humanity's problem here. Humanity is going to have a deficiency of righteousness on Judgment Day, okay? And so he's beginning to give this answer by alluding to this circumcision of the heart, circumcision performed by the Spirit. And the point is, at this point, he's not getting to the reality of faith, you know, how all this is started and how it comes about through responding to the gospel and faith. But he is giving us the divine enablement. Without this divine enablement, no one will have the deeds necessary to be justified on Judgment Day. So, again, he's getting a little ahead of himself. He doesn't really enter into the solution until chapter 3, verse 21. Well, this week, Paul's in this mini digression, okay? A little eight-verse digression. It's a foretaste of the major digression that we're going to see shortly. I shouldn't say shortly. What am I talking about? In a while, by the time we get to chapter 9, this is the major digression right here. He sets out to vindicate God's faithfulness. He anticipates, just like here, he anticipates some questions. Okay, he defends God's faithfulness at length there, but right here with the Jew, he is doing the same exact thing. He's defending God's faithfulness. That is the connection between the two of them. The theme of both digressions is this defense of the faithfulness of God. Okay, he's defending God's faithfulness to his promises to the Jews, and this is a very natural objection for a Jew who's just heard that a Gentile will be judging him on Judgment Day. Okay, so this is a very natural objection. The difference here, so they're unified in theme. They're both defending the faithfulness of God to keep the promises to the Jew. But how these digressions differ is in the approach to the subject matter. Okay, they don't read the same. They are very different, even though they're addressing the same subject. In chapters 9 through 11, this follows on the heels of God's promises to the Christian. Okay, what he's going to do for the believer. And of course, the very natural question is, well, what about the Jew? Didn't he make promises to the Jew? Is he going to keep those promises to the Jew? Yes, God is faithful. He will keep those promises to the Jew. In chapter 2, chapter 3, following on the heels of chapter 2, we're in the context of judgment, okay? He's in the context of judgment, and what he says here reflects that reality. All of his arguments center on this reality of God's judgment of the world, of humanity. And so there's a difference in the content and the manner of his response. Now, this is a very challenging passage. Many of the commentators, you know, some say it's the most difficult passage to interpret in the book of Romans. All of them agree that Paul is addressing an imaginary Jewish objector, okay? He's addressing this imaginary Jewish objector or common objections that Jews bring to him. And they see four criticisms of Paul's theology in this passage. The disagreement comes in the relationship between these criticisms. Some would look at them and say, you know, it's hopeless to try and string these together, and they just deal with them as four separate criticisms, not really emphasizing any kind of unity between them. That's the way he addressed it. And then on the other hand, there's also those who rely heavily upon Paul's other later discussion in 9 through 11. Okay, they look to that and try and seek to fill in the gaps, if you will, in this passage to kind of shore it up and give it a little more unity and have it make more sense. I believe there is a relationship here between these four criticisms. I think they kind of build on one another. What we see is the initial criticism and the second criticism kind of grows out of that one. And then the third one grows out of the second one, and the fourth one is just a similar one to the third one. There is kind of this unity among them. There are certainly unstated elements, okay, in this passage, which we will talk about, things that the that Paul kind of assumes that we as the reader understand, okay, that we're connecting the dots here and understanding his argument and the implications of some of the things he says here. And, you know, as he spars with this imaginary objector, because of these unstated elements, it makes it challenging to understand what he's saying sometimes, okay? So we'll see just how well I can explain this here. I wanted to talk about this, though. Sophistry. What is sophistry? Sophistry, this is the free dictionary, actually finds its origins way back in the teachings of the Greeks, okay? The sophists, that's a Greek word. Sophistry finds its roots in ancient Greece. And it's a method of argumentation that is seemingly plausible, though actually invalid and misleading. Superficially plausible, but generally fallacious method of reasoning. A deliberately invalid argument displaying ingenuity and reasoning in the hopes of deceiving someone. And of course, you know, the teachings and ways of teaching of the ancient Greek sophists. And so this is what Paul is up against here. He's up against a Jewish sophist today. And he's got this person who they're picking up certain themes in his teaching and then kind of trying to turn them around on him to make him sound like he's saying something he's not, okay? And this is what he's battling against, this Jewish sophist. Yes. Wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yes, I would agree. And it's, you know, like it says, it's kind of, you know, there's a kind of a sweet reasonableness to it. You know, on the surface, it makes sense. But, as you know, Paul will just make a statement and it kind of, the whole thing comes down. Because, you know, it's almost like there's an obvious hole in this person's argument here, and he points it out. Yes, you know, we get our word sophisticated from it as well. And so there's kind of this intricacy to it as well. There's kind of this intricacy, and if, you know, the sophist talks fast enough, okay, he'll convince you. Okay, but if you stop and really reflect upon what's being said, you'll be like, ah, wait a minute, there's nothing really there. But, okay. Well, let's go ahead and get into our text then. Who would like to read for us verses 1 and 2? Marianne. Okay, thank you. Jewish objection number 1. What advantage has the Jew, or what is the benefit of circumcision? Can't you just hear a Jew saying this at synagogue? Paul's just got done standing up, preaching a sermon, and he's just got done mentioning how God came to save all the world, and that there will actually be Gentiles who will be saved, and judging Jews on Judgment Day, and this guy's hand immediately goes up. What's the advantage of the Jew? What was the point of that? You know, what was the point of 2,000 years of history here prior to Christ coming? All those promises, all this work, what was the point of all that? Is there any advantage? Is there any benefit? They're pointing out that the picture Paul paints of Judgment Day would seem to indicate that there are no benefits. There are no advantages to being a Jew. A Gentile can just kind of slide right in there and get in on the promises of Abraham and, you know, what was this all about? So this is where this guy's coming from here. And Paul's answer is great in every respect. First of all, that they were entrusted with the oracles of God. We're going to kind of pick this apart here and look at it in pieces. Let's start with first of all. He says, what do the words first of all imply about what follows? Okay, there's more than one, and what he lists, what he states right now is what? Yeah, the most important, first of all, okay. But it's not the end of the list. There is more to the list, and that's why there is a link to the later discussion. And it's very clear as when we get there, chapter 9, he finishes this list, okay? He starts talking about these very same matters, and he refers to my brethren, the Jews, my kinsmen according to the flesh, who are Israelites, to whom belongs the adoption of sons, and the glory, and the covenants, and the giving of the law, and the temple service, and the promises, whose are the fathers, and from whom is the Christ, according to the flesh, who is over all, God blessed forever. Amen. So he doesn't finish this thought until then. Because of that, since it's so divorced from this context, it stands on its own in many ways, but since there is a connection, I think there are things to glean here, and I want to talk about this. In Romans 2, Paul has made much of what aspect of being a Jew? What was the chief trapping of being a Jew? We talked about trappings last week. What was the chief trapping? Circumcision, okay? Circumcision. And what was circumcision tied to? The Abrahamic covenant, okay? And in here, where is the Abrahamic covenant referred to? What description in here would the Abrahamic covenant fall under? No? I think it's under the promises. Okay, I think the promises, it would fall under the promises, whose are the fathers and so forth, but especially that statement, the promises. And that idea of the promises, that's what circumcision signified, was the Abrahamic covenant, the Abrahamic promise, if you will. Okay, and though Paul doesn't discuss the promise, he doesn't use that language in our passage, he does discuss circumcision. So that seems to be in the back of this objector's mind. It's like, what is the benefit of circumcision then? You know, if this is just, you know, emptiness, you know, what about the promises? And see, that's why it immediately leads into a discussion of God's faithfulness. Because, you know, if we receive circumcision and God's not going to follow through on that promise, but Gentiles are going to get this promise, what's the deal there? So this naturally leads into a discussion of God's faithfulness. That's where the objector goes. And so he says, first of all, let's deal with what the benefit that he names in our present passage is. He says, first of all, that they were entrusted with the oracles of God. Oracles, these are the, this word literally means sayings or pronouncements, the pronouncements of God, utterances of God, the sayings of God. I think we can safely conclude he's referring to the word. Okay, he had entrusted his word to the Jews. They were the means through which the word came. All the prophets in the Old Testament were Jews, okay? And then, of course, there's more to it than that. But when we think about this, I'll get to that in a moment. How is the possession of the oracles of God an advantage and benefit to the Jew? How's the fact that they were given these a benefit to the Jew? Okay. Okay. They're understanding him on a level that, I mean, you're going through Genesis 1. What do the Gentiles have? They just look around and see the creation, you know, yeah. Whereas God spoke, you know, he's explaining that creation, okay, in his book. And so, yeah, just like Vince was saying, and know his will. Remember, he said this earlier to them. The Jews have this. They have the will and approve the things that are essential, being instructed out of the law. They're a teacher of the immature, having in the law the embodiment of knowledge and of the truth. So what an awesome privilege. You have the mind of God. Okay, you have the mind of God sitting before you. That's what the Jews had. The Gentiles didn't have that. All right. So great advantage, great benefit there. We also see this, and Paul says this elsewhere, and this is an obvious one. And from that childhood, you have known the sacred writings, which are able to give you the wisdom that leads to salvation through faith, which is in Christ Jesus. So they had the awesome privilege of having salvation available to them. That's something that the Gentiles didn't have. Okay. You know, they didn't have this revelation given to them through which they could be saved, through which they could understand the mind of God and believe it and be saved. So some major advantages there. God hadn't given his book to just anybody. He had given it to the Jews. Now, in our present passage, what does the word entrust imply? They were entrusted with the oracles of God. Okay, they're caregivers, so they were entrusted with it in the sense of preserving it. Certainly, that they had that role and they did that. Very good job of it, actually. Now, the reason we have our Bible here, you know, several thousand years later is because for at least 1,500 years, the Jews were guardians of that. Okay. Yes. They were priests. They were via kingdom of priests. So God's truth was to be relayed through them. And they did that. We read about that earlier, how, you know, they were being teachers. Okay. They were imparting that truth to the world. So certainly, you know, that entrusting included preserving it, passing it on, teaching it, even to the Gentiles and the nations. Anything else that entrusting would? Okay. Obeying it. And that's a major one in our present passage, because that's what he's just indicted them with. He says, you haven't kept the law. You know, you've been teaching it. You've been saying it. You've been giving verbal affirmation to it. But at the same time, you don't practice it. So that is a major part. That's a major shortfall here. They did a great job of preserving it. They did a great job of teaching it. They did a terrible job of practicing it. Okay? Terrible job of practicing it. So that is the first two verses here where Paul begins to respond to this objector. He feels like he's responded to this sufficiently. It's like, how can you deny this, the awesome privilege of having the Word of God? Okay, he didn't do this for just any nation. He did it for the Jews. And so next, he moves on to the objection that kind of flows out of this one as well. Any questions or thoughts before we move on? Okay, verses 3 through 4. Who would like to read those? Yes, Andrew.
What if some are unfaithful? Does their faith nullify faithfulness to God? By no means. Let God be true, though everyone were alike, as it is written, that you may be justified in your works and prevail if you are judged.
Okay, thank you. Jewish objection number two. If some did not believe, their unbelief will not nullify the faithfulness of God, will it? Important here is in our passage, looking back in verse 2 and then in verses 3 and 4, that word entrust in verse 2, okay? The word entrust, the word translated at least in the NASB as believe. What did your translation say? In verse, if some did not, okay, well, good. You got a good translation. But in the NASB, this is translated in trust, believe, unbelief, or faithfulness, okay? All four words are the same root word, okay? And the word could mean believe. But it could just as easily be translated faithful, all right? So it could be translated faith or faithful. And the question becomes, how should it be translated in this context? The context, I would say, would point to a lack of faithfulness. And there's three basic reasons why I would see this. This is the point throughout the passage concerning the Jew, okay, is that he has been unfaithful to the law. Unfaithful to the revelation that God has given him. Secondly, their failure relates to them being entrusted with the oracles of God. Okay, this follows, and that's the same word, all right? They were entrusted. They were given this with the intent that they would be faithful to it, okay? And they weren't. They were not faithful to it. And thirdly, their failure is contrasted to the faithfulness of God. Okay, so in this verse, it's contrasted to the faithfulness of God. I think the King James Version says the faith of God instead of faithfulness of God. It's reflecting that fact that those words can be translated either way. But what an odd thought, the faith of God. You know, I don't I don't see how you could, that gets confusing fast. So faithfulness seems to be the consistent thought in verses 2 and 3. And so the objector's logic goes like this. Paul says that God made promises to the Jew. Okay. God made promises to the Jew. That's what circumcision is all about. But since the Jew is unfaithful, God will not be faithful to keep his promises. Okay. That's what the picture he just painted concerning Judgment Day. Here's this Jew. He's been circumcised. But he's not going to get the promises. This Gentile who's been uncircumcised, he's going to get the promises. So God's not faithful to his promises to the Jews. Again, you know, they're twisting this around on Paul and trying to discredit him. Now, we might be tempted at this point to anticipate Paul's argument in chapters 9, 10, and 11. All right, and in our mind, I can almost bet. I mean, when I first read this passage, you know, that's where my mind kind of goes. And it's very tempting to jump into those verses and to answer this objector this way. And of course, the answer in that passage is what? What is God's answer to the challenge to God's faithfulness? Whether or not he will keep his, what? Okay, yeah. Yeah. He will keep the promises. Yeah, he will keep the promises. He doesn't make any kind of statement that way here. He doesn't go that way. Could he? Yes, and he will. But he doesn't make that statement here. What does he say later? We'll just look at this quickly. He says, Romans 11, 6 through 7, but if it is by grace, it is no longer on the basis of works. Otherwise, grace is no longer grace. What then? What Israel is seeking, it has not obtained, but those who were chosen obtained it, and the rest were hardened. So he immediately says, hey, some have obtained it, okay? Some in the present age have obtained it. They have obtained it, you know, through the church, but they will participate in the promises made to Abraham. They will be in the kingdom, dining at the table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And as a nation, he will be faithful and keep his promises. He says, for I do not want you, brethren, to be uninformed of this mystery, so that you will not be wise in your own estimation, that a partial hardening has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. And so all Israel will be saved. Just as it is written, the deliverer will come from Zion and will remove ungodliness from Jacob. This is my covenant with them when I take away their sins. From the standpoint of the gospel, they are enemies for your sake. But from the standpoint of God's choice, they are beloved for the sake of the fathers. For the gifts and the calling of God are irrevocable. For just as you once were disobedient to God, but now have been shown mercy because of their disobedience, so these also now have been disobedient, that because of mercy shown to you, they also may be shown mercy. So the gifts and the callings are irrevocable. God will fulfill his promise to the Jew. That's not what Paul says here. Okay? That's not what he says here. That would be an answer to such an objector, but that's not the one he pursues here. Instead, he takes it another direction. He says, his response to this charge against God's faithfulness is to say that is to take it in the direction of judgment. Okay, to take it in the direction of God's judgment, and how even though the Jew has been unfaithful, and even if everyone was unfaithful, God would still demonstrate his faithfulness in the light of that. Okay. He would still demonstrate his faithfulness in the light of that. Yes.
When we think about the Jewish people as a nation, they're the chosen people as a nation. And yet, there is an individual responsibility to believe, even among the chosen people. So, you know, you have God's sovereignty,
right?
This chosen nation, and then you have the individual responsibility.
Yes.
Both are working.
Right. Yes. And that is, yes, when you get to 9, 10, and 11, that is a major theme there as far as how those two realities are working together. Yes. And at this point, what he goes on to say, and let's go ahead and look at this. His answer to objection number 2, he says, first of all, may it never be. he's making sure that we understand that he doesn't entertain this in any way, shape, or form. This is Paul's classic formula to express emphatic denial. This is equivalent to saying absolutely not. You know, he's not entertaining this in the slightest. It is impossible for God to be unfaithful, okay? It doesn't matter what the human response is. God is and will be faithful. He says, rather, let God be found true, though every man be found a liar. Let me paraphrase it this way. May we always conclude that God is faithful, though we conclude every man who has ever lived unfaithful. Okay? This has the ring of what rhetorical device? In rather let God be found true, though every man be found a liar. What rhetorical device is employed here? We've spoken about it before. Starts with an H. Hyperbole. Yes. He's stating an extreme case, an exaggerated case. Okay? He's overstating it, all right, to make a point. Now, will every man be found a liar on Judgment Day? No. There will be those who are found faithful. He's already talked about them, okay? But he's overstating his case. Say, you know, even if every man was found a liar, okay, and there was no one for God, you know, who fits the bill of this person who will be justified on Judgment Day, God would still be found faithful if he judged everyone, okay, and condemned everyone. Again, this takes the discussion in a different direction from what he does later. He does not argue that God is faithful to some Jews now or that he will be faithful to all the Jews later. He doesn't take it that way. In effect, he says, even if every person were unfaithful, God's faithfulness would still be manifested. He said, and the question becomes, if every person who ever lived proved unfaithful, how would God's faithfulness be displayed? If every person was unfaithful, how would God's faithfulness be displayed on that occasion, on the day?
By the judgment.
Yeah, and that's what he does. He cites a verse that shows that even when God judges, his faithfulness is on display. Okay? He looks to Psalm 51:4, as it is written, that you may be justified in your words and prevail when you are judged. This is almost an exact citation of Psalm 51:4 from the Septuagint, which was the Greek translation, okay, of the Old Testament. And it was the Bible of the early church before the New Testament came along. And in Romans 3:4, the NASB says, prevail when you are judged. Okay, that's perhaps a little misleading. It sounds like God is being the one who's judged. Okay, that's not really the intent of the text here. It literally reads, prevail in your judging. Okay, prevail in your judging. So it's indicating that God is the one engaging in the judging, which reflects accurately what we read back in Psalm 51. What is the historical context of Psalm 51? Does anybody know? Anybody familiar with that psalm? Psalm 51? Yeah, that's David, right? David says, for the choir director, Psalm of David, when Nathan the prophet came to him after he had gone in to Bathsheba. So that's historical context. We have a major failure here, okay? We have sin, and in that context, David writes, against you and you only have I sinned and done what is evil in your sight, so that you are justified when you speak and blameless when you judge. Okay? God's character is on display when he judges. And he's showing himself to be a faithful, just God. That's what his point is here, is that even if everybody was found a liar, guess what? God would be faithful. He would demonstrate his character to uphold his justice and judge humanity. That's part of his character there. Now, in saying this, okay, this objector, the way he's thought about this is, okay, it looks like unfaithfulness of humanity hinders the faithfulness of God. And Paul says, no, if everybody's unfaithful, God will still be faithful. Okay, his character will still be shown to be faithful in his judgment. But description of God judging, all right, his faithfulness being displayed in judging, now becomes the basis for this imaginary objector to probe further and to build his sophistry. It's like, okay, well, let me pick that apart now. Okay, let me pick that apart now, and I'm going to show that Paul is wrong here. Who would like to read verses 5 through 7 for us? Anyone? Vince. Okay, thank you. One very important phrase here that I want to deal with first. It's the statement, I'm speaking in human terms. This is his caveat for what he's saying here. Literally, I am speaking according to man. All right. He is reflecting, what in a person who does not know God. I'm speaking as a person who doesn't know God. Okay. He's not claiming that he's advocating this. He's making sure that they understand that this is what, you know, he's just saying this. He's merely stating it, the words of others, so to kind of set up his point. All right, he has a point he wants to make, and he's stating this to set up that point. It's not part of his theology. So this speaking according to man is the Jewish objection number three. And it begins in verse 5 there, but if our unrighteousness demonstrates the righteousness of God, what shall we say? The God who inflicts wrath is not unrighteous, is he? Now, I don't think we can fully understand what he's saying in verse 5 until you get to verse 7. So I included it with this. Most commentators lump it with 8. But I think the point of what this objector, what he's getting at, it comes out in verse 7. So if you look at verse 7, he says, but if through my lie the truth of God abounded to his glory, why am I also still being judged a sinner? See, Paul has just brought up judgment, and he says, look, when he judges, he's blameless, his character's on display, he's shown to be faithful. And now this sophist, okay, this is pure sophistry at this point. He is just trying to trip Paul up. He's trying to get him to sound like a fool here. And so there's this kind of circular reasoning. Now, the reasoning really deteriorates at this point. And so I would say, don't strain your brain too much to try and figure out what this person is saying. It's actually really simple and really wrong, okay? And yes.
I'm thinking of Romans 6.
Yeah, he picks up the same objection there. You're right. Yes, Romans 6:1, I think it is. Yeah, he reiterates the same objection there, and that seems to be his fuller treatment of that same criticism. That's right. Yes. Yes. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, yes. Yes, and it's kind of interesting because, Paul's not, his language, it's clear that he's answering an objection that somebody has posed to him, though he isn't saying some would say this or anything like that. He's not introducing it as if someone's saying it to him, but that is the gist of it. But I think verse 7 explains what the thinking behind verse 5. If we were to paraphrase what Paul is saying here, what this objector, this imaginary objector is saying, he would say this. So Paul, you're saying that when God judges people for sin, his righteousness is on display. But wouldn't judging their sin be unrighteous on the part of God? Unrighteousness on the part of God, since judging their unrighteousness puts his righteousness on display? See, that's what's being said here. Yeah, and you're kind of like, okay. It turns everything on its head. This is what sophistry is. And you're listening to this, and it's like, that kind of makes sense. But it goes like this. And Paul's going to kind of pull the chair out from under it. It is this idea that, okay, well, God, when he judges people, you just got done saying, when he judges people, he's righteous, and he shows himself to be faithful, and he doesn't need man's faithfulness to show himself righteous. Well, okay, but why is he punishing them for something that makes him look good? Okay, is that really just? How is that the justice of God? He's really messing with the character of God here. And so Paul retorts with another emphatic denial here. May it never be. I mean, this isn't where he's at. This is speaking according to man. This is some goofball objector who's bringing this up. He says, for otherwise, how will God judge the world? He's now using, okay, remember, the Jews still had a theology of judgment. Remember, the moralist, pagan, he's the one he has to introduce to Judgment Day. He's the one that says, oh yeah, your day's coming. Didn't you know this? The Jew knew Judgment Day was coming. He just thought he was going to pass with flying colors and the pagans were going to get judged. And so he comes back and he says, otherwise, how will God judge the world? You know, may it never be. Your criticism of my point, this is what Paul would be saying to them, your criticism of my point suggests that God can't or won't judge anyone for sin. Okay? The Jews who encountered Paul believed that God would judge the world. This Jewish objector, though, has just contradicted himself. He's just said, well, how can God be righteous if he judges anyone for unfaithfulness? Since it brings glory to him. It manifests his character. Think of it this way. We enter a similar situation when we encounter a person who says, I believe everyone goes to heaven. Or they say, I don't believe that God will send anyone to hell. And our response is what? Maybe you don't do this. We knock on doors and what do? You present them with such an obvious, obvious case where God must judge this person. We'll say, so Hitler's going to be in heaven, right? Murderers will be in heaven. You know, I'll try and paint them a picture like saying, well, okay, let's say that somebody killed, someone near and dear to you and the judge just let them go. Would they be a good judge? No, they'd be a terrible judge. Okay, well, God's the perfect judge. What should he do? See, that is where you're turning things around on them. If they have any theology of judgment, which this person does, all you have to say, so God's not going to judge anybody? God's not going to judge? Well, yeah, he is. God is a righteous judge, and he will judge you. Again, this person got caught up in trying to debunk Paul without realizing how he had just contradicted his own theology. Okay. And so Paul draws that out, and he points to it. Okay, any questions or thoughts there? Yes. This person is reacting to what Paul has just said. Because Paul has just set up a scenario where somebody has the physical sign of circumcision, which they mistakenly took for the substance of the covenant or the guarantee of the covenant. And so they're looking at this, and now Paul has an uncircumcised Gentile who will be praised as a Jew, okay, who is one inwardly, judging that Jew who is one outwardly. And so that right there, he's saying, in their mindset, like, well, how is God faithful then to this covenant, to this promise? Okay. And the everything that they have thought concerning this circumcision and all these trappings was kind of turned on its head by that statement. So now there's, well, what's the benefit of circumcision? What is the advantage of being a Jew? He says great in every respect. What does he say in then he says, what then? If some did not believe or were unfaithful, their unfaithfulness will not nullify the faithfulness of God, will it? See, they're looking at this and saying, well, they are still Jews. God made a promise to them. They're not getting past the fact that they are physically circumcised. They are really thinking this physical circumcision, okay, was it. It guaranteed the promise here. And they can't get past that. And they are tying that faithfulness to that physical reality. Okay? So you have to understand the Jewish mindset and where the Jews coming from in this to understand these objections. They're challenging Paul's theology through the grid of their theology. Okay? And Paul's trying to get them to think properly that, you know, again, he's caught up in a word battle of sorts right now with just this objector. Okay? And that it's easy to get lost in that, trust me. In preparing for this, it's easy to get lost. And he's just battling this individual and trying to match wits with them, if you will. Okay? And to show them the falsity of their thinking, their objections. Okay? He's digressed in a big way here. Okay? This is not some sort of linear unfolding of his thought here. Okay. Well, let's just finish up here with verse 8. He says, and why not say, as we are slanderously reported, and some claim that we say, let us do evil that good may come. Their condemnation is just. This is the fourth Jewish objection. It does not differ in a great way from the third objection. So Paul just kind of throws it in at the end. If sin is an opportunity for God's glory to be displayed, let us do evil that good may come. I mean, isn't that the thought here? That's where this person's taking this. They say, you know, Paul says God's faithfulness, you know, he went to Scripture, Psalm 51:4. God's faithfulness, God's character is on display when he judges. So let's go ahead and put God's character on display. The more the merrier, right? Sin, 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 and then God could show himself to be God more. Again, this is a distortion of Paul's theology. It's not a legitimate criticism. He doesn't spend a lot of time here. And it kind of goes back to that original issue. You know, let's just go live like the Gentiles. It doesn't matter, right? Paul says that doesn't matter if you're a Jew or a Gentile. I mean, there'll be Gentiles judging Jews on Judgment Day. So just go ahead and forget about the law and just live like the Gentiles. You'll end up judging the Jews. Paul's answer to this condemnation, this objection is very short here. He doesn't dignify it really with a response. He says their condemnation is just. I mean, this is totally not what I'm saying, okay, is what Paul says. They are distorting my words. They're twisting things. It's not what I'm saying. Just, you know, in conclusion here, you know, how do you apply this? we've talked about sophistry a little bit. You know, it's interesting, as I thought about this, I thought about Proverbs 26, 4 through 5. Do not answer a fool according to his folly, or you will be like him. Answer a fool as his folly deserves, that he not be wise in his own eyes. We see a little bit of that going on here. And it's interesting, these verses are back to back. I mean, you have Proverbs 26, 4 and Proverbs 26, 5. What's interesting about these is that the first part sounds contradictory, because literally what it reads is, do not answer a fool according to his folly, or you will be like, you will also be like him. And then verse 5 says, answer a fool according to his folly. You know, so, well, which is it, Solomon? Should we not, or should we? You know, it's interesting. The answer lies in the second part of that. He says, or you will be like him. You know, there. If you have to sink to their level, you don't want to become like them. Okay? So there is a time, there's a certain, you can't go there because you'll become like them. But then there is this instance where, or you know, there is this realm in which you do answer a fool according to his folly, that he not be wise in his own eyes. Paul's doing a little bit of that here today with this imaginary objector. He pauses to deal with these objections so that, hey, you know, the guy needs to know the faultiness of what he's trying to do here. He's trying to dismantle and pick apart. There's nothing to his attempts here. Paul goes along, he pokes holes in them, but then it comes to the point where it's like, this is so ridiculous, your condemnation is just. Okay? And it comes to that point. You don't want to sink to their level. You don't want to become like him. You don't want to just become this bickery, you know, fighting individual who, you know, resorts to such base ways of proving your point either, okay? So there is a time for it. You just need to make sure it doesn't go too far. Any questions or thoughts here tonight? Yes. Yeah, Dwight.
I kind of see this as a roundabout way of attacking grace.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if we sin greatly and God forgives greatly, why not sin all the more? I mean, it demonstrates his grace all the more. And then tie that to the Gentiles. I mean, really, to think. I mean, Gentiles are major trophies of grace here.
Mm-hmm.
And so why not? Why don't we sin all the more?
Yes. Yeah, that is one root that would give birth to that same thinking. Absolutely. Anyone else? Yes, Michael. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Absolutely. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. That's his more positive. And you're right. The attitude is different there. He's dealing with somebody who's antagonistic here. And it's just like, shut up. You know, I'm just trying to get you to shut up. Verses 9, 10, 11, I think there's a legitimate place here to ask. It's like, well, what about the Jew? You know, and he takes the time to teach at length on that matter for those who are having that. Say again. Oh, yeah, exactly. And that's what he's dealing with here. And that's why I think it can be confusing sometimes. Well, what is he saying? You know, is he really promoting? No, I'm speaking according to man here. Anyway, let's go ahead and take some prayer requests.